Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with a reading of a supplemental chapter, an epilogue, to researcher Ed Haslam's remarkable book published in 1995 entitled Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, The Story of an Underground Medical Laboratory. This book stemmed from the investigation into the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman, one of the foremost cancer researchers in the United States and also one of the foremost medical personalities in this country in the second half of the 20th century. Ed Haslam has developed some very compelling information that Dr. Mary Sherman, an associate of Dr. Alt Noxner, also a prominent figure in American politics and medicine, and an individual whose INCA, the Information Council for the Americas, a far right-wing propaganda outfit and apparent intelligence front, was involved with a series of interviews in which Lee Harvey Oswald, himself a probable U.S. intelligence operative of some kind, was recorded proclaiming his Marxist sympathies. This was broadcast in the wake of President Kennedy's assassination. It created the impression among many that the communists had killed Kennedy, and many researchers feel that this led to a cover-up of Kennedy's assassination in order to prevent a Third World War, which might have stemmed from the public perception that the communists had killed Kennedy. Ed Haslam's also presented some very compelling information that Dr. Mary Sherman was associated in this underground medical laboratory in some way with David Ferry, a far-right-wing activist and CIA contract pilot connected with the U.S. intelligence community's secret wars against Fidel Castro in Cuba, and that in turn the focus of this laboratory was experimenting with cancer-causing monkey viruses. And Ed Haslam's also developed some very compelling information indicating that Mary Sherman was working on a secret project in which a linear particle accelerator was being used to mutate the SV40 monkey virus, that's a cancer-causing monkey virus, which had contaminated the polio vaccine in the 1950s in hopes of creating an anti-cancer vaccine to prevent a cancer epidemic. In Haslam's original work, he develops very compelling information indicating that there is currently a soft tissue cancer epidemic sweeping the United States, quite possibly stemming from the SV40 contamination of the polio vaccine. In his epilogue, Ed Haslam has traced down the linear particle accelerator, where it was, and we're going to get to that, and some of the unique features of this. Ed Haslam's source on this was a Dr. X, who in turn had been associated with a Mr. Y, who had been employed as a career professional in installing linear accelerators. And the linear accelerator that he installed in New Orleans had the following characteristics. And I'm going to summarize these points. First of all, the project was extremely secret. Mr. Wyatt had to sign a secrecy contract with the government before taking on the project, and he was forbidden from disclosing the location of the accelerator. The design of the accelerator was unusual. There were no ramps for wheelchairs or beds for patients to lie down on, and in fact, the objective of the accelerator was some form of laboratory experiments. The overall design of the accelerator was unusual. It resembled an octopus. The accelerator's particle gun was located on the top floor of the building, and it pointed down toward a platinum pyramid, which broke the particle beam into a number of equal segments. And that pyramid was made out of platinum. The funding was unusual. There was $10 million paid in advance, but the various checks were drawn on a number of different accounts. Mr. Y received some five or six checks totaling $10 million within 1 week. And Mr. Y went to New Orleans for the construction of the machine and then did not go back for a long time. Suddenly, something went wrong, and Mr. Y was called back to the accelerator in New Orleans, and the accelerator was being guarded by soldiers with submachine guns. Inside of the building, there were thousands of mice in cages, and they were apparently working on some kind of vaccine experiments. Dr. Alt Noxner was in charge, and Mr. Y described him as being tense and extremely suspicious. And Mr. Y also discovered that upon his return home, military intelligence had been investigating his girlfriend while he was away, tending to the accelerator. So obviously, this was no ordinary accelerator project, and Ed Haslam continued his search, described in this epilogue, for where the accelerator was located. And we resume with Ed Haslam's epilogue at that point. And the tour here is a tour of Children's Hospital in the University section of New Orleans between Magazine Street and the Mississippi River near Audubon Park. And resuming with Haslam's text, after the tour, we went outside and joined a crowd of about 100 people who had gathered near the hospital's main entrance for the dedication ceremonies. I escorted my mother. We stood in the sun and listened. Speeches from local dignitaries went on for nearly an hour. I was hot and bored. My mind wandered. I started looking around and noticed a group of old buildings across the street. They were surrounded by an unusually high brick wall. I studied the scene carefully. Several buildings were visible. All had pitched roofs, and it had been built of brick in the federal style of architecture common to the years before World War I. Fungus grew on the portions of the wall shaded by the ancient oak trees. I realized that I had never seen anyone go in or out of this facility. In fact, it appeared to be abandoned, all of which made it seem rather mysterious. The windows of the building closest to the wall appeared to be boarded up from the inside. The general look was very governmental and very spooky. I wondered what it was I didn't know. Finally, I asked my mother. She said that it was the back entrance of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital and that I should be quiet and listen to the speeches. I obliged as best I could. Actually, I was busy pondering what a great location the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital would be for covert operations. Trucks full of whatever could drive in through the wooden gates on the one side of the campus, and cars can enter from the other. Once the gates were closed, no one on the outside would have any idea what was happening inside. Machine guns, I snapped out of my reverie. U.S. Public Health Service Hospital was operated by the U.S. military. Here was a place that could have had soldiers with machine guns. And who would go into a quarantine station unless they had to? What a great place to set up a secret laboratory. The U.S. Public Health Service had crossed my path several times during my investigation. The two most important were, Ochsner's FBI file showed that at one point Ochsner had received covert payments from the U.S. government at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. In 1960, Dr. Sarah Stewart left her powerful post at the National Institute of Health to join the U.S. Public Health Service. That same year, Dr. Bernice Eddy announced she had found a cancer-causing virus in the monkey kidney cells upon which the polio vaccine was grown. By the way, Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy were the two people for whom the S.E. polyoma, standing for Stewart and Eddy, was named. That's the virus that was almost identical to the SV40. In fact, virtually identical to the SV40. Both are cancer-causing viruses and cause cancers in multiple animals. Continuing. Finally, I had a possible location. The U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. Now I needed confirmation. I had to get someone on the ground in New Orleans to look for more information. Who to ask, and who to trust. There were two brothers in New Orleans who I knew by reputation. Both had grown up in uptown New Orleans and were interested in the Garrison case. I called one of them, Romney Stubbs, and asked him if he would help me with some research. He agreed. I did not tell him about Dr. X, Mr. Y, or any of the information I had gotten from them. I only asked him to see if he could find any information which might indicate whether or not there had ever been a linear particle accelerator on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. 1 week later, he called back. Here is what he had to say. The federal government had sold U.S. Public Health Service Hospital to the state of Louisiana in 1986 for $1. In 1987, the state began renovating the buildings. In 1989, the state opened the facility as a long-term medical care facility for teenagers. He knew one of the patients and went to see him. He asked him if he knew anybody who might know about, quote, the old days, unquote. The patient gave Romney the name of a building manager who had since retired. This man had been directly involved in renovating the buildings in 1987. We will call him Mr. Z. Romney tracked down Mr. Z and interviewed him. No, he had not seen a linear particle accelerator, but he did see some very unusual things when he first came on board. He explained the situation. The campus had about 10 buildings, one massive building, which was the hospital itself, and 9 or 10 smaller buildings, some of which were residential in design. Mr. Z's first task was to plan for the renovation, so he had to thoroughly inspect all the buildings and inventory the situation. Mr. Z noted that all of the buildings except one were in comparable condition with old desks and file cabinets full of papers scattered throughout the buildings. It was what one might expect to find in old government buildings whose funding had been gradually phased out. The only exception was a 3-story building toward the back of the campus. It was completely empty. There was not a single desk, file cabinet, or piece of paper in the entire building. It had been swept clean. Everything had been carried off except 2 pieces of medical equipment. There was a large microscope and a tissue slicer used for making microscope slides. It had obviously been some type of laboratory. Romney continued, Mr. Z had been trained as an engineer and had worked with electrical systems in large buildings during his entire career. He knew what to expect. He remembered the building with the microscope because the electrical wiring was very strange. In fact, he had never seen such heavy wiring in a building before. It had obviously been for extremely high-voltage electrical equipment, more powerful than any he had ever encountered. The equipment had been removed, but the wiring was still there. Mr. Z also noted that some of the rooms had very unusual features. One room had metal walls which were grounded by heavy cables. He described the other room as a circular-shaped, quote, operating room, unquote, on the ground floor. It was surrounded by a group of small, airtight rooms which were completely lined with 1-tenth-thick asbestos sheets on doors, walls, and ceiling. I barely noticed that Romney had stopped talking. The silence hung in the air. He said, "Well?" I was speechless. Finally, I mustered a, "That's it." He laughed and said, "That's it? That's what?" "That's the building the accelerator was in." "How do you know?" "Because it matches the description that I was given by my source. It is exactly what we were looking for. It's just that I didn't really expect to find it," unquote. The heavy-gauge electrical wiring was to handle the huge electrical currents required to run the 5-million-watt accelerator. The room with the metal walls was the control room. The metal walls were to protect the operators from the radiation. The heavy-gauge grounding wires were to reroute any errant electricity down to the ground. The airtight asbestos-lined room were the chambers that the radioactive beam had been deflected into. What he described as the, quote, operating room, unquote, was where the pyramid had been. The accelerator itself and the platinum pyramid had been removed, and the building had been cleaned when the lab was shut down. All that remained were the hard-to-remove items like the high-voltage wiring, the metal walls, and asbestos-lined rooms. Romney sent a hand-drawn map of the campus and photographs of the key buildings. The accelerator had been located in the Infectious Disease Laboratory building of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. The dimensions of my investigation had suddenly changed. This was not a ragtag operation run out of David Ferry's apartment. It was a full-blown, U.S. government laboratory financed with millions of dollars from the public treasury. A state secret supported by the most powerful political forces in the land. A medical Manhattan project set up in hopes of protecting the public from an epidemic of cancer which the government itself was largely responsible for. Mary Sherman had been electrocuted on U.S. government property. She was stabbed in the heart and relocated to her apartment to preserve the secrecy of a covert domestic operation of the U.S. government. This was the most explosive political situation imaginable. Now, I understood how the police investigation into her murder had been shut down. It was power in its purest form. The feds told the New Orleans Police Department to shut down the investigation, or else. Now, we had the answer to our pivot question, and the incidental pieces started to fall into place. For example, I had always wondered why the electrical damage to Mary Sherman's body was primarily in her right arm. By the way, her right arm was essentially burned off. Continuing. Why hadn't the electricity traveled down her leg to the ground and exploded out her foot as was common in high-voltage electrocutions? The grounded steel walls provided the answer. The bolt of electricity had come from something Mary grabbed with her right hand. It traveled up her right arm and exploded out the back of her right shoulder into the grounded steel wall behind her. Since steel is a more conducive substance than human tissue, the surge of electricity went into the steel wall and then into the grounding cable, rather than down her leg into the wooden floor. The room was like a giant spark plug, full of juice and ready to explode. Since her arm was the weakest part of the grounding path, it, quote, burned out, unquote, the way that the soft metal in a fuse burns out when too much electricity goes through it. So what did she grab? And why was it loaded with electricity ready to climb up her arm? I discussed the situation with a radiology technician. She pointed out that if you had an electrical problem with a machine, the standard safety procedure was to grab the circuit breaker by the handle and pull it down. This would shut off all the electricity to the machine. Whoever was running the accelerator would have been trained to grab that handle at the first sign of trouble. However, if someone wanted to sabotage the laboratory, a good way to do it would have been to tamper with the machine's wiring and run the main power supply back to the circuit breaker. Whoever grabbed the handle would be electrocuted. Sabotage. Finally, the elusive image of our mosaic had started to appear. Finally, I had a theory that started to explain our story. The trail followed the polio vaccine. It all started back in the 1950s at the height of the polio vaccine inoculations. The moment Stuart and Eddie discovered cancer-causing viruses, top government scientists privately feared that there might be a problem involving the contamination of the polio vaccine. By then, they had already inoculated millions of children. They immediately branded the problem as national security to keep it secret, and then quietly asked Dr. Ochsner to look into it. Not only was he the former president of the American Cancer Society, but he had already lost one grandchild to the polio vaccine. They knew he understood the problem better than anyone. It was 1957, the date of Ochsner's first, quote, sensitive position, unquote, for the U.S. government. Soon, they identified an Asian monkey as the natural host of the cancer-causing polyomavirus and gave the virus a less hysterical name, SV40. Then they found the same virus in the monkey kidney cells upon which the polio vaccine had been grown. By 1959, the government knew they had a problem. Vice President Nixon knew he had a problem. He had rebuilt in the National Institute of Health after the Cutter incident. By the way, the Cutter incident was the development by Cutter Laboratories of the initial polio vaccine, which turned out to be a disaster and made many of the people upon whom it was tried extremely sick, and it also killed many of them. So that is the reference to the Cutter incident. Continuing, he, Vice President Nixon, had signed off on Sabin's polio vaccine. In fact, in terms of domestic casualties, he was holding the political roses of the biggest problem in the history of the United States. It threatened to destroy the careers and reputations of everyone involved. The legal liabilities were astronomical. The political consequences were incalculable. It was the most politically sensitive secret in America. They had to do something about it, and whatever they did had to be kept super secret. Disclosure was unacceptable. Dr. Ochsner was offered a second assignment, to develop a vaccine to prevent an epidemic of soft tissue cancers. It was a noble cause, but an extremely dangerous project. They would be using radiation to mutate monkey viruses. What if something went wrong? What if they accidentally created a terrible new disease? By the way, Ed Haslam also theorizes that AIDS may have stemmed deliberately or accidentally from this same line of experimentation. We haven't got time to discuss that, but it is discussed at considerable length, not only in Ed's book, but also in the 3-hour interview that I did with Ed Haslam, and that interview is available from Spitfire. Continuing. Ochsner agreed on the condition that the work would be done on U.S. government property. There could be no question about the fact that he was working on a national security assignment at the request of the highest officers of the U.S. government. If anything went wrong, he had to be clear of personal responsibility, and there could not be any rub-off liability for Ochsner Clinic or Tulane University. It was October of 1959, the date of his second, quote, sensitive position, unquote, assignment for the U.S. government. The wheels were set in motion. By 1960, the team was assembled. Ochsner was formally separated from Tulane. Sarah Stewart, M.D. and Ph.D., was recruited as the scientific director of the secret project. She was the most famous cancer researcher at the National Institutes of Health and believed that an anti-cancer vaccine was possible. For her, it was a once-in-a-lifetime chance to have all the power and all the resources she needed to develop an anti-cancer vaccine. Stewart left the National Institute of Health and transferred to the U.S. Public Health Service for the project. She secured the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in New Orleans for the project. Nixon ordered the CIA to take millions of dollars from their laundered bank accounts to pay for the machine. By 1962, the linear particle accelerator had been installed and the secret lab was fully operational. Ochsner and Stewart brought Sherman into the project. They both knew her, trusted her, and respected her knowledge of the effects of radiation on cancers. At this point, I realized there were two underground medical labs in New Orleans in the early 1960s. I will call them the Big Lab and the Little Lab. The Big Lab was the U.S. government's lab at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. It had the linear particle accelerator, and it was where Mary Sherman died. It started around 1960 and continued until Mary Sherman's death in 1964. In the Big Lab, Mary Sherman was a high-level player who directed the medical research. Due to the security around the project, anyone involved in the lab had to have a high security clearance, so they needed to find someone with a high security clearance to do the day-to-day work, like take care of the mice and prepare tissue samples for microscopic examination. Ferry had the right security credentials because he flew missions for the CIA, and he needed a job because he recently lost his position with Eastern Airlines. David Ferry became the low-level player brought in to do the routine lab work. our most elusive and persistent question had answered itself. My guess is that Mary Sherman's only contact with David Ferry was through their covert working relationship in the big lab. Sherman's professional colleagues had no way of knowing she knew Ferry, and Sherman had no reason to tell people she did. But Ferry's situation was different. As Ferry's life collapsed into alcohol and drug addiction, he continually, quote, shot off his mouth, unquote, about his covert activities to impress his young friends. He used the fact that he had once worked with a famous cancer researcher like Mary Sherman to bolster his image and to prove his legitimacy as a cancer researcher. This is when Ferry listed himself as Dr. David Ferry in the phone book. Sherman's death demonstrated the political risk of the covert medical research at the big lab. Enormous political muscle had to be mobilized to shut down the New Orleans Police Department's investigation so abruptly. The big lab had to be shut down as well. The accelerator had to be dismantled. Mr. Y was called in from Boston to survey the damage to the equipment and to make sure the accelerator could be safely removed. Ferry was ordered to dispose of the mice, which of course he agreed to do. Instead of disposing of them, he brought them, or at least a large portion of them, back to Louisiana Avenue Parkway. There, he started the little lab near his apartment and kept the infected mice alive for future use. Therefore, the dates of the little lab would have been from the summer of 1964 until Ferry's death in the winter of 1967. Did Mary Sherman ever go to the little lab on Louisiana Avenue Parkway? My answer is no. While I consider the odds to be extremely high that David Ferry knew Mary Sherman through a custodial role at the big lab at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, Sherman died before Mary brought the mice back to the little lab on Louisiana Avenue Parkway. Even if Ferry planned to use the viruses as a biological weapon, Mary Sherman should not be associated with those motives since she was already dead. I challenge any researcher to come forward with real evidence to support the claim that Mary Sherman was David Ferry's closest female friend. What about Inca, Oswald, and the radio debates? Did any of that fit in? Was it part of the larger pattern? I picked up the phone and called Carol Hewitt, H-E-W-E-T-T, the attorney who had helped me during my research. When she answered the phone, I simply said, "Hello, we found the accelerator." "Where was it?" she countered with equal brevity. "At the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in New Orleans." "Hold on," she replied as she typed the words U.S. Public Health Service into her computer. "Here we are. It's in Volume 19. "Volume 19 of what?" I replied. "The Warren Commission volumes. The FBI went to the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital on 11/25/63 looking for evidence that either Lee Harvey Oswald or A.J. Haddell. Let me begin again. "Volume 19 of what?" I replied. "The Warren Commission volumes. The FBI went to the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital on 11/25/63 looking for evidence of either Lee Harvey Oswald or A.J. Haddell." In parenthesis, I would add that A.J. Haddell was one of a number of aliases Oswald appears to have used. Continuing. "They went back a second time on 11/26. The FBI looking for Oswald at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital? I could hardly believe my ears. Why?" According to the Dallas police, Oswald had a vaccination card issued to him by the U.S. Public Health Service on 6/8/63 when he lived at 4907 Magazine Street in New Orleans. It was issued to Lee Harvey Oswald and signed by Dr. A.J. Haddell. The FBI reports are in Volume 19. I'll send you the citations," unquote. Had Lee Harvey Oswald been on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital at the time the linear particle accelerator was there? Take a look at this map, and the map shows the proximity between a number of the key sites in Haslam's narrative. Continuing. "Does it strike you as unusual that both Lee Harvey Oswald and Dr. Alton Oxner both live within 1 mile of the most secret government laboratory in America?" Now, the timing of Sherman's murder came into focus. With Oswald in the picture, the fact that Mary Sherman's murder happened underneath the noses of the Warren Commission's investigators took on a whole new light. Had someone sabotaged the linear particle accelerator in order to create a high-profile incident that would blow the cover off the secret laboratory and call attention to its connection to Lee Harvey Oswald? And what would have happened to the lone nut theory if the public found out that Lee Harvey Oswald had been spying on a top-secret U.S. government laboratory? Would it have seemed unusual that the doctor who ran the same secret government laboratory had also arranged the radio debates which discredited the soon-to-be-accused assassin of the president? In my opinion, whoever authorized the sabotage of this laboratory was well aware of Oswald's proximity to the lab, Ochsner's connection to Oswald, the FBI investigation of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, and to whom the trail of accountability would lead once the public discovered that the government was secretly mutating monkey viruses because they had contaminated the polio vaccine with cancer-causing viruses. The sabotage of the linear particle accelerator was a hardball tactic in a big league game of power. In this bold arena, our celebrated concepts of truth and justice give way to more fundamental questions like, who rules, unquote. Mary Sherman was the incidental victim in a war between political titans. Luck was not on her side. If Dr. Ochsner had grabbed the lever on the circuit breaker, things would have been different, at least for Mary Sherman. If the plan to expose the secret medical experiments at the infectious disease laboratory of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in New Orleans had worked, American history may have turned out differently. It didn't. And once again, you can obtain the entire book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory, published in soft cover by the Wordsworth Press and authored, of course, by Ed Haslam. You can dial 1-800-MONKEY-X. Once again, pick up your telephone and dial 1-800-MONKEY-X. And there's also an address for Wordsworth. It's located in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I believe the address is 1700 Montgomery in Albuquerque, but I'm operating from memory. I've also alluded to the various interviews that I've done with Ed Haslam, the three-hour interview in which we sum up his book, as well as two supplemental interviews, each an hour in length. Those are available from Spitfire. That's a tape duplication service that stocks all of the various programs that I've done. Once again, their mailing address, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005, email address alcalame@ix.netcom.com. You can also check out a list of and descriptions of all of the programs available from Spitfire by dialing up the KFJC webpage on the World Wide Web. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org. Once again, that's www.kfjc.org, and look in the Public Affairs section. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.